Welcome back, guys. This is the Poor Pearls Almanac. No, it's not the poor. I do that literally.
This is the poor scientist.
This is the poor science almanac. So this is obviously a very special episode. We have our opportunity to do this in person, which never really happens. And we wanted to take advantage of that. So today we're talking about overpopulation, ecology, and what else are we talking about?
How humans are not the problem.
How humans are the problem. Heard it here first. So yeah, we released an article. We got some feedback. So we want to kind of go through some of the stuff that was in there, answer some questions, really try to tie some of the stuff together in a way that I think, you know, I think personally, and I'm not going to speak for you, I think the left has this really complicated relationship with this idea of like overpopulation. Like we're very against like that very Malthusian idea of like overpopulation, because then it means which people are going to not get to populate. And obviously that gets really ugly and messy pretty quick. So like, I think we all agree on that. And then there's,
but I'll say that there's still a good portion of the left, whatever it is, right? Like, we don't know. We're not saying that the left is a singular entity with monolithic ideas, but there's parts of, you know, so-called leftist spaces that I think still believe in ideas that Thanos was an eco-fascist. That is true. Yeah. But I think there's still factions of the left that do believe things similar or adjacent to overpopulation ideas, right? Like, because they all stem from this idea that like the only models that we have, or the only experience that we have of human beings being on this planet, are just like stories of destruction, and that's the only relationship that we have with nature. And I think there's a lot of ideas like that on the left, right? That are like, we need to basically just have no interaction with nature. We need to not include animals in our food systems. There's this idea that separation is like best for nature, which I think still stems from the concept that humans are the problem in some way, right?
So yeah, hold on one second. All right, sorry. We had children running around. So I think that comes, I think people get, there's a faction of people that follow that understanding of relationship with the land. In terms of like, okay, humans aren't the problem, but like there are natural limits, yes, theoretically, yes, to the landscape.
Yeah.
And I think that's where it gets really kind of
messy.
And I also think that we're so quick, and this is like a left problem in general, to like then, you know, take that opportunity to try to talk about that nuance into painting people as like eco-fascist. And like that's also, you know, not really helpful, because you're basically gaslighting any meaningful conversation about the subject. And there is a lot of really interesting things to talk about around this subject that isn't just, you know, the idea of, you know, overpopulation is, you know, a myth. And I mean, and we're going to talk about why it kind of is a myth. But like, I think we don't really engage in meaningful conversation around the subject. So that's what I'm hoping we can kind of do here, because I think there are some really important points to bring up, and also counterpoints to those arguments that I don't think we ever get to see, because those debates devolve very quickly into, you're just, you
know, name calling, yeah, isms, like you're whatever, this, you're that, yeah, you know.
So that's something I do want to talk about a bit. What else do we have on the docket?
That's pretty much it. And I mean, I guess we can get started. So one of the comments that we got, that we frequently get when we talk about this, is that there has to be a limit, right? This general idea that there has to be a resource capacity, a certain amount of resources that can support a certain amount of people or a certain amount of living beings on this planet. And once that whatever arbitrary threshold is exceeded, there's a problem. And whether or not we've reached that, that's different. But people often, even well-intentioned people, will say that, well, there is a limit. And I think to add nuance to that, yes, there is, within an ecosystem, there is a limit, But a lot of what we understand about limits and what we understand about our ecosystems is within the context of capitalism, is within the context of like whatever we've known for the past couple hundred years, which is really nothing in the grand scheme of how long humans have been here on this planet. And based off of that very small time frame is where a lot of the theories about what we think we know are really drawn. And this isn't just for ecology, right? Like this is basically medicine, for example, right? Everything we know about how we understand like our place in the world, right? Like what makes people sick? A lot of what we know based on modern medicine, right, which is colonial medicine, is based on what we know from the last couple hundred years. And it's a very skewed understanding of what makes people sick, right? And I think in the same way, everything we're going off of, all of the models that try to model what our carrying capacity is, our planet's carrying capacity is, are very, very reductive and very much biased and shaped by a colonial system that was predicated on extraction, endless extraction to no end, right? For profit accumulation and wealth hoarding. And so that's what we know about how much our planet can take. And to that extent, I would say yes. Our planet has absolutely reached some sort of a capacity, right, under these extractive systems, that there's definitely a limit and ecological crises and everything we're seeing related to climate change and environmental disasters is a result of way surpassing that limit. Not humans, a very extractive, exploitative system that commodifies human beings, plants, animals, the land, right, and extracts resources at a rate that are not necessary to sustain everybody, but are necessary to maximize profit, right? Which is the goal of the system.
Yeah, and today, even if, I think a lot of people, a lot of researchers will say that the carrying capacity of the planet is 10, 11, 12 million. We already grow that much food today. Obviously, there's this really interesting relationship of the fact that the food we grow today is, built on a petrochemical agricultural system, which, I think anyone watching this is aware of the fact that that cannot continue forever. But we've seen and we've talked about even on this show, on the Poor Pearl's Almanac, the fact that we have alternatives that can be just as good at producing food. And if we can be better about getting food to people, then with less waste, we can actually increase carrying capacity or care. We can increase the population of the planet today to a higher amount without growing any more food. So like that, that's the first point. And obviously you'd say, okay, well, what if there were 30 billion people on the planet, 50 billion people at some, what if there was a person on every square foot of, like at
But
some.
that argument is kind of like, where is
Yeah,
it
yeah, yeah.
going?
And this brings up a really important point though, about like, okay, yeah, let's talk about that. Like, what does it mean to say I think there's 7 billion people right now on the planet, give or take. What does it mean to say, oh, we're going from 7 billion to 30 billion? Like, what does that rationally and logically say, right? Like, is this a mathematical or a scientific, like, logical test, or is this something that can actually happen? And to that point, like, the planet's carrying capacity isn't really known
It
because
can't be.
it's complicated, right? Like, the way we do the mathematical modeling today on carrying capacity is based on the way we grow food today.
And I mean, it's the entire system of science, right? Like to even take a big step back, just like the question, is our planet's carrying capacity really known? That's very similar to, do we know why people around the world see increasing rates of like chronic illnesses? To answer that question, right? Colonial systems of science and medicine take a very reductive approach, right? Like these systems were built on the framework of exploitation and as tools of population control, right? So that shapes how the science is done. And so when they're trying to answer that question, they don't take into account like the million variables in our environment that are shaping like the final outcome, right? The observation. So I think to answer that question, everything we know about all the models that currently exist, that will give you a number. If you Google that question, you will get a number somewhere,
And
right?
there'll be a pretty vast discrepancy in what those numbers are.
Exactly. Yeah.
Some folks have commented on our post on Instagram that carrying capacity that they saw was 2 billion. Most people that study in this space argue around 11 to 12 billion seems to be the most pragmatic number, based on the way they're doing that mathematical formulas right now. But again, if we talk about what this entire project has been about, that's not really relevant because when we talk about growing food, it's fundamentally in a different way, right? It's in relation to the landscape. It's restructuring what our relationship is with food and food systems and ecology. And that changes the game quite a bit.
Everything. Yeah, it changes everything. I mean, so if I was answering that question, what, like, this is the biggest problem we run into when we talk about these things is people's understanding of the world is very much based on how they understand the world within colonial capitalist systems, right? So a lot of this is about imagining outside the boxes and cages that we've been raised in. So, what would human health look like if we were living not under these systems, right? Or even if you had more community, period, even under existing systems, right? If you had more a more communal network that you're a part of, that would dramatically change your health outcomes, right? And medicine does not account for that. It will never account for that, right? And in the same way, if you actually had a fundamentally different infrastructure, that the way that you're structuring your community, the way that you're actually building a relationship with the land that you're on, that's going to change our whatever community's carrying capacity is, right? Everything we know about carrying capacity is how capitalism has done it so far, which is by far, honestly, the most inefficient way to do it. Right. I think thinking about I think a good book to read for this would probably be The Solutions Are Already Here by Peter Gelderloos, which gets into in a very accessible way with no political theory, basically. If you read English or you can even translate it, it explains in a very simple way how states, right, hierarchical systems, nation states, which are very, very young in the grand scheme of human history, right? So something for something like this scale to exist, where entire millions and also billions of people are being homogenized to be controlled and regulated by a state government, right? That how states across time have been very destructive and surpassed their carrying capacity in the local ecology that they exist in, right? Empires have collapsed and died out because they've exploited their resources and the land to point that it cannot possibly sustain them. And so there is a point to be made, right? I think ecosystems do have a carrying capacity, so to say. And if you look across history, time and time again, hierarchical authoritarian systems and empires that are, built on, predicated on controlling people and exploiting them and the land, right, have absolutely exceeded that carrying capacity. And we're facing a lot of the repercussions of that, right? But in terms of the planet's carrying capacity, that's a whole different question.
Yeah, so there's also like two things I do want to bring up. So the first is the Maya. The carrying capacity of the Maya through the Milpa system is comparable in terms of its productivity in a a forest setting as to like most urban civilizations today. Now, if you take that same landscape today using conventional agricultural methods, it's considered a low productivity landscape. So like that's just like a microcosm of like why what we're talking about vastly changes those variables. Now, the second piece of it is when we talk about carrying capacity, something that I think gets conveniently missed is that basically most species naturally self-regulate their populations, whether it's coyotes, which use their calls in the wild, which directly impact how big their litters are that they carry, to many, many other species,
Plants, trees, yeah.
plants, trees, and so on, tend to find a way to self-regulate their populations. And part of that is the size and capacity of a community, and it's relate those species' relationship to their community.
And a lot of this we don't actually fully understand. If you think about even microbial communities, they do a good job of regulating in terms of not ever exceeding and maintaining a certain amount that's enough to keep the ecosystem or ecological niche that they exist in sustainable, not just for themselves, but for everything else living in that ecosystem, right? Regulating your numbers, not just to survive just in a self-centered way, but also what is best for the land that exists itself. And a lot of what we know is we can't really comprehend that. There's so many variables that go into that that we don't really understand, but I think we still think the same principles apply to human beings.
Yeah, and when we talk about this idea of carrying capacity, we even under capitalism, we still see it. I mean, if you think about it, I think when most people talk about the current state of late stage capitalism, right? That like the issues we've sent overseas are coming back home, right? That's like the general idea. Like we've outsourced cheap labor, and there's been, you know, that's becoming less and less effective at, you know, making the rich wealthy. So now they're extracting more and more from home, right? That's why the middle class has been decimated, right? Like we all understand that. And in that process, even under capitalism, you know, why are birth rates low across the industrialized world? It's because as those conditions come home, we're naturally self-regulating in many ways.
Yeah.
We're,
same thing with countries that are so-called developing, so-called third world, you know, previously colonized countries, in terms of why families have many children. That is a form of regulation where it's in response to like striking intergenerational poverty and the total like being severed from the basic resources that you need to survive and not having any access to mobility, essentially. So the only way that they're even able to put food on the table is by having more children and having more people go out that can then sell their bodies in the form of labor and get something back home, right? So it is a form of regulation in response to fabricated scarcity.
Yeah, even under capitalism.
Even under capitalism, so, people are trying.
So like even under the system, we're seeing in some, I mean, most 90% of researchers in this space will say, we're expecting populations to cap in 50, 60 years and then either stay there or start going down. So like this, so like to get back to this idea of is overpopulation or, you know, is that ever going to be an issue? No, because to go back to that idea of like, you know, if we can't support 30 billion people. Sure, that's probably true. I'm not going to debate that. But
the question is why debate it?
Yeah, but and that's the point. Like, but the point is that number could never happen because we self-regulate between even under capitalism, especially as we build better, more resilient communities. That, you know, that's like arguing like, what if the sky was red? Or, you know, like
exactly. It is a ridiculous question. And I feel like we get in this conundrum a lot on the, again, the so-called left or anyone that's a proponent of like science and medicine, right? Because we've been used to looking at the natural world in such a mechanical, objectified, lifeless lens, where all we know how to, like what to do when we're in crisis is to try to study something, quantify it, measure it, dissect it mechanically, and think that we can, you know, objectively find our way through like to solution to a problem by reducing something to a metric, right? Like that's how we've been taught to approach problem solving. And I think it goes back to like this question of carrying capacity. Why is it important to answer that question? Right. Like we have like asking
it's
a question.
Flawed question.
It's a flawed question. Right. So it's very similar to when people ask, what are the genes that are responsible for ADHD or autism or like bioessentialism? It's the wrong question to ask, right? It's entirely predicated on this colonial understanding of the world. And that same way, asking the question, well, can our planet support 50 billion people is like, why do we need to answer that? For what, right? So what can come out of it? Because, and we're saying this because people do draw conclusions from the overpopulation idea, right? People do draw quote unquote solutions, right? So the history of environmentalism has like drawn solutions in terms of what measures need to be taken to then reduce populations, right? And who gets to do that? So a lot of the times when these questions get brought up, the question is, why do we need to ask that question? For what, right? Like, what is going to come out of it?
Yeah, it's a precursor to, you know, again, falling back on tropes of specific groups of people and so on, without addressing the fundamental issue that it doesn't matter, because as long as even under the system we live within, we respond to the supply conditions that we live around. And if we don't, you know, I think there's a lot of things we're still going to learn about humanity and how we deal with overpopulation, like as our genetics and so on, that will become more apparent.
But I think social ecology like has a better framework, I think, of looking at select communities across history and how they've regulated and self-regulated and response to, you know, their land changing, right? Ecological issues. For example, the Harappan civilization in India that basically saw that they were reaching this carrying capacity based on their extractive practices, based on being a hierarchical empire, essentially, that is very centralized and issues orders down to communities. And they realized that that was causing them to destroy the land that they were on. And they responded to that by changing the fundamental way their communities were structured, decentralizing, breaking up into a bunch of tiny communities that they then scattered across the river, which eventually ended up over a, you know, a couple hundred years restoring the land that they were on, and they're still here. So to, you know, there's ways that communities over time have responded to like seeing that there's something off. And in a way, isn't that what we're doing, right? Like, isn't like just people around the world asking the question of like, capitalism clearly is going to kill this planet. Like, that is what we're doing. We're self-regulating. We're responding to us being very aware that we are reaching that carrying capacity, not in terms of people, but in terms of the systems and the level of destruction that they've caused and continue to cause. And I think in that way, we're very much still responding like a lot of communities have responded, and structuring our communities differently would dramatically change how we're able to care for each other.
Yeah. And I think with that idea, like, it does, it's going to take time. And fortunately, as a species, our reproductive process is not a quick thing. You know, we're not popping out kids a few years after our birth.
Every 20 minutes, like bacteria.
Yeah. And that allows us to have these thoughts, these conversations, to fully understand the conditions which we would be raising children within. And I think especially for folks that are probably listening, the chances of you having children is probably far lower than previous generations, if I'd asked that question 30 years ago. I also think that the amount of children that the average listener that does want to have kids is probably far lower than it was, again, 30 years ago. And that speaks to the fact that we have internalized this relationship and what we believe the planet can support. And in that process, it's a microcosm of that self-regulation, the same way a community of birds or bees can do the same exact thing.
Yeah.
By each making individual choices, by having the same experiences, those choices will be very similar.
Yeah.
Because the conditions around them
are similar,
are directing those decisions.
Yeah. Like, I mean, people like, you know, me being very aware that just even people questioning the nuclear family model, right? Questioning the systems and infrastructure that we're living in, questioning the 9-to-5 job life and infrastructure, right? Questioning whether this is the way we're supposed to be living, and seeking out community, trying to build those relationships, trying to move outside the nuclear family model, even seeing how we can be caregivers to children that are not children that we ourselves birth, right? Seeing how we can be there for each other as partners outside the realm of romantic dynamics. I think these are all examples of self-regulation, right? Like, these are things that are naturally emerging around the world in response to crises, in response to people's isolation and alienation and health crises, and us realizing very much so as millennials that we have no safety net and security. We're going to, at this rate, if I try to support myself for the rest of my life in isolation, I will work up until I'm 95 and die, right? If I can even live that long, my lifespan is probably shortened by the systems I live under and the toll that they've taken on my health. So we've realized already that this is not working, and come up with like very different ways, right? Not someone else's way of how they've responded to the shit ton of just distress that capitalism has released onto their bodies, different than what I've decided to do. And that's shaped by my unique variables and their unique variables, but we've tried to respond, right? And we've responded both at an individual level and a population level. And that has happened at several layers, right? Local communities and people around the world. And we see patterns in ways that people are responding. And I think there's something beautiful about that in terms of, like, kind of like Andy said, we're asking the question, like, why do we need to be talking about overpopulation? Because communities, insofar as they have relationships with each other, right? People that have a relationship with each other, a local community, can figure out how to, if given the choice, if given the chance, can figure out what decisions do they need to make for their collective well-being without an authoritarian external force that is forcing them to comply to a set of rules, right? Forcing them to do certain things. And without that, that communities would be very much capable of figuring out how to be malleable and adaptable to emerging crises.
Yeah. And I think all of this comes back to this idea of how do we relate with the ecology, right? And I do want to talk about this a little bit. We didn't talk about it too much in the actual piece, chapter 4, but I do think it's important to discuss, given I think the audience that's probably watching this is, what does that what does it mean to feed people locally, and how does that relationship work, right? So we have, especially here in the United States, we have a very weird relationship with the idea of growing food locally. We imagine it generally as like an individual farmer or a series of homesteads, and a lot of very well-intentioned, thoughtful, caring people have this vision of like, you know, in the future, we're all going to have homesteads, but we're going to share. And that's cooperative, without addressing the fact that that's not the goal. Like, at least to me, that's not the goal. Like, yeah, I enjoy growing food. I enjoy doing these things. Me growing an acre of carrots to share with my entire neighborhood mm-hmm. isn't going to scratch that itch of my relationship with the landscape. Mm-hmm. And it's not going to be super efficient.
It's not going to actually feed the community.
Yeah. And like, even if we can all grow, you know, in our backyards, like that's fine and all, but it's not, the goal isn't to go back. We have this technology that exists today, mm-hmm. And these resources and this knowledge, this incredible, you know, generations of knowledge that exists both in traditional systems and in conventional, you know, academic systems that together can really build these amazing ways to grow food very efficiently, where we have great relationships with where the food is coming from. It is local, it is healthy. Mm-hmm. And instead of that, we have a good relationship with the ecology around us. We don't need to all be growing food. What we all need to be doing is having a relationship with the ecosystem around us.
And like, figure out a role in community.
But I think in terms of like, when we talk about this idea of like, everyone needs to have a relationship with the land, what that really means is the ecology, because what that means is, yeah, we can have a handful of people that are growing most of the food, but if we all have a good relationship with the landscape, we can very quickly identify if we're doing something wrong, if we're pushing the landscape too hard, if, you know, some new techniques having some unexpected consequence.
And there's many examples of that, right? Like, having said that, this isn't just a result of like modern technology. This is how collectivist communities have existed for eons, right? Even without said technology, just the idea of operating on a collective scale. So I think keeping in mind, whenever we try to solve problems, a lot of the times we fall back on using the same logic that we've in the same way that we understand the world, right? Like, so if our understanding of our world is we've grown up and been socialized under capitalist colonial systems to think of ourselves as quote unquote individuals, right? And been told for years, right? Like in authoritarian systems like school, that you have to be independent and self-sufficient and you have to provide for yourself. And that's a metric of success, right? If you are financially independent, whatever it is, right? This hyper-focus on individualism. So a lot of the times when we try to address our problems, right? Whether it's figuring out how we can grow food better or how we can take care of each other's health, we fall back on individualistic solutions, right? So whether that's thinking, oh, a bunch of homesteads are going to do that, right? As long as I have my individual, like, you know, I'm ultimately sort of trying to be self-sufficient, right? Or even thinking that, you know, we can take these like individualistic consume products through like self-care, self-help approaches, that's going to fix our problems, right? Even if it's individual distress, and we're missing that collective piece. So I think thinking about like, this is what we know under colonialism, right? This is what we know under the world that's been built for us and that we've been born into. But even within that, collectivist communities, like, depends on which community you come from, right? But like growing up, I had an understanding that we just live as a community where we have big families that all live together. And the whole goal is like splitting up responsibilities so that we can care for each other. And at some point, yes, that was a response to poverty. But again, I think it says a lot about how communities have responded to distressing situations by banding together time and time again, right? Regardless of what that distressor was, regardless of whether you were pushing back against a colonial empire, and all the above at the same time, right? Like fighting scarcity. You come together and try to fix those problems as best as you can as a collective and not as like a bunch of individuals just trying to like throw each other a bone, I guess.
Yeah. When we talk about this, I think all of this kind of really gets underscored by this idea of multi-generational living or mm-hmm. multi-generational relationships, right? Mm-hmm. And one of the things I think that we see a lot of, let me think how I want to phrase this. So especially in the homestead and like the permaculture and all these communities, something that constantly gets brought up is this idea of tree crops, which I'm a big advocate for, of, you know, growing, you know, food perennially, right? These long-term multi-generational food systems. The thing that I think gets complicated about it is that when we talk about that, people immediately go to, if they're not in support of it, this idea that, you know, we need to figure out, or, you know, you're not going to eat those things, or, you know, how do we build that into our food system? And I don't care, frankly, because the point of that is that we're building an infrastructure for future generations. You know, when we talk historically, you know, when we look at the way food systems have changed across the globe, and I'm not talking the last 200 years, I'm talking about, you know, the generations upon generations previously, those systems were built over dozens of generations. You know, in the New World, as the colonists showed up and they saw these trees, those trees that were 500, 600, 800 years old, they were still not at their end of life. As far as I know, there was no documentation of any trees that were really at fully end of life, which suggests that the systems were still somewhat new and evolving, right? And even then, when we talk about, you know, the pilgrims coming to the New World and, you know, the corn and all that, corn had become, and there seems to be some new documentation on this that kind of argues on this idea that corn was relatively new to this part of the Northeast. And when we talk about, you know, well, corn was a big mainstay of the indigenous diet here. While it was, they still kept their relationship with the landscape outside of that corn very similarly. They still maintained through burns, through, you know, selective tree production. As researchers are looking deeper into the work that people had done, as you start digging into some of the old documentation that exists from 100 years ago of people getting into this idea of tree crops, perennial crops, there's documentation of nut trees with, you know, that basically they're described as domesticated nut trees that were growing in the wild with hyper thin shells. Like, there was absolutely selective breeding going on. And that was something that was continuing at this time, you know, as colonization began. So that was something that was still a fluid process for future generations. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we get into this idea of indigenous culture, and we kind of fetishize it as like the static thing that they had it figured out, right? And that really wasn't the case. They were still figuring it out, refining it, making it better. And that is, I think, the fundamental thing that people really struggle to grapple with. And that's part of the world that we live in, where we think of things as static, right? Our tastes, we try to imagine as static. When you see something and you like it, you know, a new outfit or whatever, you know, a new, you know, modern furniture, you know, whatever it is, right? You buy it and you don't think like, I'm going to hate this in 10 years, right? You think like, this is my favorite thing right now. And that's part of, you know, that's a consequence of the system we live within. But when we start talking about like building food systems, we have to understand that they're fluid, that they're something that's going to evolve. And our job isn't to have the answers. Our job is to build the foundation for future generations to work from, so that they have something to work with. And, you know, what we give them won't be perfect. And like, we have to accept that it's not going to be perfect, but it's something.
And I think there's a lot to say about not being able to have the answers. Like, we just don't actually have the tools to do that, right? Like, we can't really, not just can't we not predict the future, but we don't actually have all the variables and understanding of what, like, an evolving, like, all the variables that would come with even one variable being changed in our ecosystem today, right? So how would that change ecology tomorrow? There's so many variables there that we just cannot possibly predict what that's going to look like. But I think that comes with a certain level of humility too, to our approaches, right? This understanding that we're not trying to save anything. What we're trying to do is just, we're trying to save the environment. that we're just trying to do our part, given what we know and the resources that we have, and do the best that we can for future generations, while understanding that we don't know everything, we can't know everything, we cannot predict how this is going to go. And therefore, like, we just have to keep our, it basically means we create systems that are more adaptable, that are more malleable, structures that can change and respond to like evolving, emerging community needs that we can't predict, right? So it actually that humility of I'm not trying to control what people decide to do, right? Whether it's tomorrow or in a different community whose needs I cannot possibly understand, right? I'm not trying to build the system that will go control them and tell them what to do. That's not going to be the key to my liberation. It can't, right? And I think just understanding that creates solutions that are actually a lot more sustainable and effective in the long term, because you're not creating a rigid system, which by definition capitalism is, right? And a very centralized, rigid system that makes it really impossible for people to, as we're seeing as a result of like ecological crises and climate disasters, right? That these are the emergent like issues with this system that was created with this exploitative foundation and hierarchy and centralized nature built into it, that it is so hard for it to respond to problems.
Yeah. Yeah. And that, you know, just for an example, that today we spent the day planting nut trees. We did a little guerrilla gardening, got some black walnuts and a number of other stuff in the ground. And chances are I shall never see any of those
I
nuts.
Won't. I put a lot of work in, but I won't.
I worked her hard today. and I may or may not, but like the reality is that like someday someone will be happy that tree is there.
And I mean,
or those trees are there.
Or those trees are there. Yeah. And I mean, that's the idea of reciprocity, right? The difference between reciprocity and transactionality. And this is something that's actually the fabric of a lot of collectivist cultures, right? When we think about culture, it's predicated on this idea that we're creating something beautiful just because it matters, right? That gives our life meaning and purpose. And there has to be no other greater like end to that. The means is all we have. Right. And I think it creates like what we're trying to do is essentially go back to that collectivist culture, right? Find it, whether it's like reconnecting with your roots, whether it's just understanding the local ecology of the land that you're on, right? Because that's just where you are now. And that's what you have to anchor into. I think it just reminds us of the fact that like we're just doing what we can, not because we're trying to save something, but it's also going to, you know, yes, we're thinking about future generations, but it actually gives us meaning and purpose to do these things, right? It's like why we're alive. Like, what else for, right? If not to do this, like, and it's kind of the same, like, I think conundrum we get into when we think of like self-care, right? Actually giving care and equitable reciprocal relationships involves you receiving care just through that process, right? And it works the same exact way with ecology, right? Like just giving care to the land, not just for you to harvest today, right? For other plants to thrive, for the ecosystem to thrive as a whole, you inadvertently fully understand that this is going to affect your survival. Right? You may not even understand all the variables. Like, why am I actually making this land offering? How does this exactly impact me tomorrow? Right? I don't need to know. I know it matters. I know it will affect my livelihood. I know it will affect my well-being. I know it will affect my community. And that's it. I understand that it does, right? And I think that's a lot of what culture is about, having belief and faith in that it matters what we do to each other, right? It matters how we treat each other. It matters whether we're building systems for ourselves selfishly or keeping in mind 100, 200, 300, 400 years down the line. Inadvertently, it will help us survive better today, right?
Yeah. And to that point, like, well, actually, I'm not even going to say that. So you know, I, you know, we've talked a lot about this idea of like food systems, and I think we've pushed back a lot on like the homestead, the vegan thing, and like I think a number of different like I think tropes that pop up when you're in this space. Like, I think if you're interested in food and growing food, like you inevitably are going to get involved or take a side on, you know. Well, I don't even want to say take aside. I think like we fall into
just run into these issues over.
Yeah. And I think a lot of us, even if we don't, if we're not vegetarian or vegan, we'll fall into the, well, it probably is better. We should eat less meat, which is, you know, there's some validity to that to an extent. Or like homesteading, like, yeah, we should all be growing a little bit more food. If we all grew a little, you know, if we all grew tomatoes, then like, you know, we'd save X amount of carbon emissions or, you know, whatever it might be.
Yeah.
But again, I think those fall into these, you know, ultimately these like individualist, singular issues where we're not addressing the fundamental problems of the system that we live within. And ultimately it doesn't challenge because the system will continue to grow if no one challenges it, right? It will eat any opportunity the same way, you know, as homes became more efficient, had more insulation and so on, they actually began to use more energy because people would build bigger houses. So like it fundamentally didn't, having hyperinsulated homes didn't change anything. We use per person more energy to keep a person heated and cooled during summer and winter today than we ever did before, despite the fact that we have all these, crazy technologies to make your home super efficient, super, insulated, super triple pane glass, all these things. Because what ends up happening is we end up scaling up because of these new efficiencies. And that's part of the system that we live within, right? Because those relationships of who decides what a house looks like, how big it is, and so on, are typically outside of like a community and how it affects a community.
Yeah, and I mean, like, kind of like Andy said, even though we've been taught to think about problems in an individualistic way, that we respond with individualistic solutions, and what we're talking about is like a bigger scale in terms of stepping back and looking at the big picture, but that's not something that just distraught, like, we're not just driving despair, right? Like, so we're not saying that the individual can't do anything,
I am.
right? I'm, yes, maybe we are.
Kidding.
Because, like, I think that I've seen on the left at least that because people are so focused on what we're against, right? That we're so focused on systems, right? Systems we're trying to tear down, like systems of colonialism and capitalism, these systems of food production that it can actually drive despair and hopelessness. And I understand that, right? Because what does it give people to work with if we're just criticizing the system, right? And I think
But it's fun.
it is fun, and we get great memes out of it, right? Like, we've gotten, you
That's
know,
we are the meme generation.
we are that generation that copes with our trauma and distress by making memes. But at the same time, I think thinking about what you're for actually gives you, even if it is like something like Andy said, right? Like, thinking about whenever we come up with solutions to our problems, right? Our individual problems, right? Whether you're having issues in your relationship, whether you're trying to save money on groceries, whether you're trying to figure out like where the fuck like your chronic pain is from and what to do about it, right? The solutions that we come up with, the steps that we take, our actions, and how we show up in the world is actually dictated by the systems that we live under. So if we're aware of that, the way that we can respond to that in a more collectivist way is like tangible things that you can do in your day-to-day life, right? Like, it changes the decisions you make. Like, if you think over pop, if you genuinely believe that humans are the problem, right? And like, what does that say about how you live your day-to-day life, how you engage in relationships, right? And how well is that going to bear for your health, right? Like, how's that going to affect the health of your community then, the land that you're on? It's a ripple effect. It actually does matter, right? These beliefs about systems and how we respond to them, whether we fall back on capitalist ways of responding, actually makes a difference in our day-to-day life. And the moment we kind of shift that way of thinking, it does change how we show up in our relationships. And at the end of the day, that is the kind of like bottom up sort of like collective change that we're looking for. So it does impact systems, even on a micro level, right, in our day-to-day lives. Yeah.
Yeah. Well
Thanks.
said.
That was profound for like 3 seconds.
Yeah. So, sorry, the screen keeps going dim, so we both reach to touch it every time. Yeah.
Questions?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I guess if folks want to chime in, we're happy to hear what you got to say. I think we've covered most of the stuff we wanted to tonight.
Yeah, and I mean, I guess like the one thing that we did write about a little bit, but we didn't talk about too much, is it's good to always think about the origin of some of these ideas and myths and where they come from, right? We talked about the system that they developed in, but a lot of these were just, you know, brought forth by very mechanical, colonial trained environmentalists, scientists, whatever, right? That had a very clear context in which these ideas emerged. Right. And even if you don't know any of that history, it's not that important if you just start asking simple questions like, what does this mean? If I believed in this, what would that mean for the world? Right. So don't worry too much about knowing everything. Just like
No,
question
you have to
it.
know everything.
Yeah.
It's
Yeah.
everyone's got a homework assignment, 50 pages every
You
night.
have to read lots of political theory to
Yes,
survive.
that's how you will figure out how to be a good person and care about your neighbor. We have a reading list. It's 450 books. Once you're done with it, it'll probably have another 150 bonus books that are required if you want to
And
be
if you don't
truly a
constantly
good.
stay updated with political theory,
Yeah.
then are you even a real leftist?
Yeah, how will I know how to be a good person? But seriously, like in this process of thinking about overpopulation, it's really important to remember that it doesn't matter, is what we're getting at, because it it's a pointless conversation. What's more important is to understand our relations to one another, mm-hmm. our relations to the system around us, and to engage with that system in a meaningful way, right? So growing food is fine. How are you relating to your neighbors with that process? How are you empowering your neighbors with building a relationship by having grown that food and sharing it with them or whatever? Mm-hmm. How do you get into your local ecosystem and harvest some hickories or whatever? And then, you know, maybe instead of eating them, you plant them, because you know what? 10 new trees is much more important than, you know, a glass of hickory nut milk or whatever. You know what I mean?
As Zach asked you, think you end up on a list if you Google industrial society and its future.
I mean, if maybe. Yeah, that's very possible.
Yeah, I think if you think about anything about the future, you may end up on a list.
I'm pretty sure if you're watching this, you're probably on some kind of list someplace. That's true. You can just accept that now. Every time there's a list that comes out, it is so big. Like, you think it's like a couple hundred, and they're like, oh, there's 400,000 people on this list. And you're like, oh,
you know, that's actually a good thing. That's actually a good thing. We're getting a lot of people to care very deeply about things that threaten the power of the system, which means we're doing good.
Yeah. And to my point, or today's point, mm-hmm. You know, it was really interesting that today we spent the day basically all day in the woods, guerrilla gardening and picking ticks off each other. Because we got to spend some really interesting time in the woods. For some reason, I let Aisha lead us back to the car and we got lost. So that was on me. I'm sorry, everyone. But the point was that, like, we got to spend some time, start relating with the landscape in a new way. And I think really just being, you know, vulnerable enough to, you know, you plant these trees with the hope that, like, these are probably where these trees would be. You know, where I live, the landscape's been clear cut so many times. There's really not much seed bank for the mature forest to come into the landscape. So what I spend a lot of time doing is going to the few places around here where hickories, black walnuts, you know, mature oaks and so on still exist in meaningful capacity, harvest from there, and then try to plant a bunch of stuff where it otherwise is not, because it takes a long time for that seed to travel. Mm-hmm. And like we'd said, you know, we don't know. And there's, you know, in that process of planting new things, many of them aren't going to survive.
Yeah.
You know, we planted a bunch of choke berries today that, you know, we'll see. We'll see how they do. The black walnuts, the same thing. The beech plums, the same thing. Elderberries, you know, a number of other things that we put in the ground today, that, you know, I'm hoping that in 10 years, like 10, 15, 20 years, I'm harvesting from those and plant, you know, extending that same system and building on it every year. And, you know, if I'm not here in 100 years, which I won't be, obviously, those trees will be there for someone else. Mm-hmm. And at least a couple of them, hopefully, will be there for someone else. And they'll also feed the non-human world. And I think that's really important to remember, too.
Yeah. And I mean, to respond to that, like, what are some actions that we can take? I think that we were actually talking about this on our way back from planting these trees, that, you know, when you don't really need theory when you have community and knowledge sharing. And that can be intergenerational too, right? Like, that traditionally stories and storytelling, being in community, just being in the presence of other people that are both similar to you and different to you in many ways, right? That in itself is going to create all of this knowledge sharing that happens intergenerationally, cross community. And just by that, we are learning a lot of things, right? So if theory is something that allows people to understand the state of the world in a certain way and give you helpful solutions that you can apply to your day-to-day life, great, right? If that's a route that someone wants to take, that's fine. But fundamentally across time, right, the way that people have made sense of the world that they're in, the problems that they're facing and how to survive as a collective, right, and make way, even if it's a little bit for us, to, you know, someday actually like have a better life, right? Whatever that looks like, it's happened by just talking to each other, right? And caring about each other and asking each other, like, you know, what we don't know, right? Like learning from each other's experiences, not having all the knowledge yourself, but ultimately surrounding yourself with people that have a collective knowledge. And together, you know, a lot. And that growth of knowledge will only, you know, exponentially grow over time, right? Because yeah. like as a collective, you grow together.
Yeah.
So I think in terms of what you can do, like be with people, like just relationship building is the most important way that you can not just have knowledge and gather it, but actually do something with it.
And that I want to bring up a little story from today, actually, another story. So we did this project, we ran some errands, and one of the errands was I had to pick up hay. And we were chatting with the very right-wing folks that work at this farm store, and they had some seagrass, which apparently is grass that is harvested from the sea as like a mulching material for like garden beds. And I guess that's something that's only around here in the Northeast. But we were chit-chatting, and we started talking about invasive species, and that she also was annoyed that it wasn't easier to do stuff like harvesting invasive species or trying to restore conservation land, which we had just been doing a few hours earlier that she did not know about. So I think we get trapped in this idea sometimes that people that don't agree with us politically don't agree with us on many things. And the reality is that that's not true. It does matter how you engage with that conversation. But in reality, you know, we're much closer in alignment with on a lot of things than I think we give ourselves credit for. And yeah. I think for some people that's scary because that means
we have to work through a lot of complexities.
We do have to work through a lot of complexities, but also that, like, if I have things in common with somebody that I think is evil, then like,
ooh, what does that say about
yeah.
me?
Yeah. So I think there's a lot of layers.
Well,
to
we're
that.
Questioning binaries, yeah. right? We're questioning the whole good and bad binary and understanding that. And there's obviously boundaries to this, right? There's a limit to like the
straw man.
Straw man argument.
Yeah.
Nope. There's obviously boundaries to like the type of people we can be with, right? But as long as we're open-minded and understanding that like we have to question ourselves constantly in terms of what we know and what we think we're right about, it just like, you know, you look at the world through different perspectives each time, right? Through the eyes of other people. And I think understanding that we have a lot more in common than we think, it's usually what I lead with in relationships, right? That there's a lot more that we share that we have in common with the average person that you meet than you have like that you're at odds with, even though there may be things that, in complexities that you have to work through. And most importantly, those complexities actually help you grow and teach you things you never thought you would learn. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I watched Aisha get very white this week.
She
like nodded, doing the nod.
But okay, by that, to clarify, not white physically, white as getting in paler. We're in a small town that is disproportionately, you know, white. Very Caucasian. And like maybe the average age here is like over 70.
It's and, not that bad. I mean, it's like over 55. Of,
no, okay. Well, that says a lot still. Either way, I've perfected my what I call my white smile, which is like, you know, when you cross each other in a hallway or like you see someone hiking and they're white and they're like, yeah, like I don't know what that like I came here as an adult, so I don't know what that, you know, why people do that to each other. I actually get called aggressive because I don't smile at random people in hallways because I think I should sit down and talk to them when I have time. Why would I just do the like, I don't know. Niceties are weird to me. Respectability politics. Ugh.
Yeah, so it's been a week for some of us. we're super excited to do this. We're having lots of fun. If you guys have questions, let us know. We are going to be doing another chapter probably in like a month or two.
Yes.
And yeah, anything else you want to bring up?
Take care of each other.
Take care of each other. Wise words from a newly whitened woman. So hopefully you guys enjoyed this. We had lots of fun. And we'll see you guys some other point. Right?
In the future.
Are we?
Yeah, of course.
I haven't scared you away?
No, not yet.
Not yet. That's the spirit. That is how you build community.
Tarts.
Is that what? I thought you were flipping off the camera.
Oh my God, no.
Okay.
I'm not flipping off whoever's watching this. That's mean. Do it with me.
Do I don't
it's
know
like what, this. Just do it like
what is this?
Andy, like okay, this.
Okay.
And then this.
Like this?
Is your thumb really short? I think it is.
I just have fat fingers.
Oh my God, you have such a, okay. I don't think Andy can do this. but he's doing it.
I'm trying.
Cheers and shit.
In spirit.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. If you, so I'm assuming you guys know who both of us are, but if you don't, go follow Aisha at Woke Scientist and Poor Pearls at Poor Pearls Almanac, which I guess you would at least know us because it is our handle.
Yes.
So there. And then again, if you guys hopped in halfway through, probably in the next couple days, I'll get the audio up on our podcast so you can go listen to the same thing there.
So. And there'll be a video on YouTube, like usually. Oh, yeah.
It usually loads the in day a couple after. Hours.
Yeah, or in a couple hours. Yeah, yeah. And that's just on the YouTube channel, a regular recording.
Yeah. So we'll see you guys around.